From KLCC Media, this is the Oregon Grapevine. I'm Barbara Dellenbach. The Oregon Grapevine highlights fresh-pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live. Dow Orion is a permaculture designer, teacher, and homesteader. She and her husband consult on holistic farm, forest, and restoration planning through their company, Resilience Permaculture Design. Dow is the author of Beyond the War on Invasive Species and is a member of the Lane County Climate Action Committee. Thank you so much for being here today for Oregon Grapevine, Dow. I really appreciate your time.
Sure, it's great to be here.
Let's start with the word permaculture, which is thrown around a lot. I hear it a lot. What is it?
Well, the concept is based on kind of a series of traditional agricultural concepts and practices from around the world. And it was brought together in the 70s by Bill Mollison and David Holmgren, who were kind of trying to capture the essence of what makes cultures and agriculture, which is a huge part of our societies, our food production systems, what makes them sustainable and even regenerative over time. And there's some principles that kind of run through many traditional land stewardship practices are encapsulated by permaculture.
With kind of the concept of permaculture and looking at what you can do and can't do, it seems to me that it's easy to kind of think in the big term, permaculture farms, or I'm going to grow this or grow that. But what about bringing it down in terms of just a person's house? They're listening to this and they have a backyard that's not particularly big. Where should they perhaps start thinking in terms of how they can really make it work at their house?
Well, one thing that's really great about the permaculture concept is that it's more about thinking in terms of systems and holistic systems, where you're placed in relationship to nature, you know, which we're a part of. So it's really even, you know, from the smallest apartment up to the largest scale forestry or agriculture system, everything that's going in and out of that unit is part of a bigger picture of relationships. And so the kind of fundamental piece about permaculture type thinking is starting to understand what those relationships are and starting to kind of integrate some of them. And ideally, the more that you can build relationships among the things that you use and create in your process of your day-to-day lifestyle, the better, and the more that we can kind of see those relationships as building up biological diversity and watershed health and contributing to overall ecosystem function and process, that's kind of what a permaculture approach to landscape design is looking at. So it's not so much like you need to have a big piece of land, but you're kind of starting to think about reweaving the relationships of engagement with your place. And that might be something like putting in a patio garden and, you know, just taking back some of those relationships that have been commodified in terms of needing to go to the store all the time for your food or flushing away all the water from your sink into the sewage system. Maybe thinking about putting in a gray water system to make use of that water one more time in the landscape before it goes into the sewage processing facility. You know, there's all these different kinds of ways or nexus points that you can think about it in.
Let's go to water. You brought it up. Let's talk. We can talk certainly about, I'd like to talk about gray water. I'd also like to talk about water catchment. Is it legal? Is it not? How does it work?
Well, in Oregon, you know, every state kind of has its particular laws, and then county and city regulations differ as well. But water harvesting is generally legal throughout Oregon in tanks. So you can put up a rainwater harvesting tank in most situations. I believe in the city of Eugene, you do need to get a permit for it because they are kind of, they tend to be larger kind of features in the landscape, and just making sure that the engineering is stable in terms of all the weight that's going to be placed in a particular location. When you get into groundwater or building ponds and things like that, there's a little bit more of a regulatory framework around that. And so it really kind of differs site by site, but that's something that we work with people a lot in terms of creating viable legal water harvesting systems on their properties. It's definitely possible. Just there's a couple hoops to jump through, but yeah, there's, you know, it's interesting because in the state of Oregon, all groundwater is owned by the state. So you kind of have to get a permit to apply to use it. So whether that's for a well where you're pumping it out of the ground, or you have what are called water rights, which, you know, many big agricultural producers have, where you're pumping out of a surface stream, or if you're impounding water in a pond, which could affect downstream water rights holders. That's essentially, or, you know, water for fish. That's kind of what the Oregon Water Resources Board is looking at when they are assessing your application for water storage on your site.
I had a recent conversation with someone who was talking about water rights and land. The fact is that, let's say you've got some water in your neighbor, you built the dam kind of on your neighbor's land, that, or whatever, maybe a dam is not the exact correct word, but I think it is, and then it goes into your land, and then your neighbor's kind of building a dam on your land. It's a very cooperative kind of system to make it work while you have these rights. Yet you can help people downstream as opposed to fighting with people downstream. So how does that work? Do you have thoughts about that?
So water rights are particularly from surface, like running streams, are a particularly interesting concept. Many of them, most of them are dated, so they come from about the 1860s on up through the probably 1950s or 60s. They haven't been giving out that many since then. So they're kind of based on kind of the age of them in terms of what you're able to take out. And if there is a water shortage, the ones that have the rights from older times get a higher priority in terms of being able to use what they've been allocated. We haven't reached that point very often yet in Oregon, although I'm anticipating that that's going to happen more and more. I know on the east side that has become more of a thing, and sometimes there's a few places in southern Oregon where less senior water rights have been essentially shut off later in the summer. It's kind of an interesting thing. It, from a more like permaculture water harvesting angle, we're not looking so much at pumping water out of existing streams. That's not the orientation that we take. And, you know, I have seen instances where, you know, existing water rights are really impinging upon, you know, downstream water availability for fish and other riparian species. And I think that it's going to become more and more of a concern as there is less and less stream flow in some of these streams. The permaculture kind of orientation around water harvesting is to do off-channel upland catchments that are actually serving to augment flow and water holding capacity in the soil upstream and kind of uphill from actual streams. So we're never going to be building a dam in a stream in our work. We're always going to be looking at in-soil, off-channel catchment possibilities that, you know, have been shown to actually augment stream flow. If there's enough of them and they're in the right place, they're actually contributing to holding water longer in the season in the upper kind of reaches of the watershed, because so many of our streams have been compromised by upstream activities like logging and, you know, poorly managed agriculture and trapping of beavers, et cetera. But many of them are channelized, and so the water that runs down into them during the rainy season just kind of goes away relatively quickly. But what we're looking at is trying to find ways to hold that water longer in the upper reaches so that it can be slowly recharging into the streams throughout the dry season. That makes sense.
It does make sense, and I know we could delve into it more, and I don't know that,
yeah.
I think it's digging into the weeds, as it were, a little bit. I'm not going to go there, but I do think it's really interesting. I want to talk for a minute about gray water, because in part I want to direct this conversation a little to maybe what someone can do. So let's talk about gray water at your house. What is that exactly, and what can you, let's say you collect it from your dishwater or whatever you're collecting it from, how do you do that, and then what do you, what can you and should you do with it?
Well, gray water is all water that's coming out of your house that hasn't come in contact with human waste, essentially. So it's all the water that is not your toilet. So that can include your kitchen sink, your dishwasher, your bathtub, and your laundry, especially if you're not washing diapers or something like that. And basically, there are, throughout the state of Oregon, you can create legal systems. And what they look like is mostly piping that water underground and distributing it to the roots of landscaping plants. So it's not something that's ever going to be in contact with the surface of the soil, which, you know, even with like kitchen sink water and things like that, because there's food particles in there, you don't want to have that kind of active decomposition on the soil surface. So you create systems that are keeping that water under the surface of the soil and actively watering your landscape plants.
And relatively easy to do once you know what you're doing.
They're relatively easy to do, yeah. And there's design specs for the legal systems in Oregon. And the legal systems do require a permit, but they're relatively easy to set up off the cuff as long as you're keeping the water underground. One consideration is, you know, you have to kind of think about the products that you're using in your sink and laundry and bath and things like that. And so switching to more natural detergents and soaps and things like that is a necessity, because you don't want to be putting some of the more fragrance heavy or chemical surfactant heavy soaps and detergents into your food. Ostensibly, you would be using to water the water for.
Let's move a little bit to food and kind of food security and making that, how permaculture and how what you're doing and how what people might do fits into making food more available, because I believe that's turning into, I don't know if it's yet a crisis, although I think it is a crisis in some places. What is happening around here, giving an optimistic view on making it more accessible? Are there projects in place?
I would say there's a lot of things kind of brewing around that, and there's been some efforts here. I live outside of Cottage Grove to develop a more kind of local food system amongst the farmers and food producers in this area, just to kind of create more of a network and a market for some of the products that people are producing here. Also getting them into schools in terms of like the school lunch program and things like that. So there's been some pretty active projects there, you know, and there's just a lot of really great initiatives around Wayne County and Oregon in general. There's the Farm to School program, which is kind of a bigger network of getting farmers' produce into school lunches. And there's many kind of community garden type initiatives around that are helping people access fresh food in areas where they're historically underserved in terms of grocery store access and things like that. So that's really exciting. You know, my kind of orientation has been around teaching people how to grow food and just kind of setting up systems, you know, from that apartment patio scale that I mentioned before, all the way up to, you know, bigger scale farms, just kind of how can we get as much self-sufficiency? I'm not so into that concept, but more like neighborhood, community self-sufficiency. I don't necessarily feel like everybody needs to grow all their own food, but if we can kind of set up systems that make sense, depending on the scale and context that you're in, and then have these kind of mutual aid networks where we're helping each other fill in the gaps based on, you know, if I have a little more property, I might be able to grow dry beans or, you know, lamb or something like that. and have that available as a trade item. Those are kind of the things that I like to think about and build.
Certainly in my lifetime, it was that you would go to a grocery store and it was extremely hard to find organic produce. And when you did eventually find organic produce, it was much more expensive, et cetera. I think now certainly it's easy in Eugene to think that that's something that's easier, that people understand organic produce is actually potentially better. We're not throwing pesticides in. There's a million reasons why it's healthier for people who are eating it and for the planet that is growing it. But yet I think there's still a feeling that it's, you know, that's for kind of rich people. Why should I do organic produce, et cetera? Is that changing? Do you see an education happening to say, no, actually, in the long run, it's better in, for these reasons?
I think it is. I think that more and more people are understanding kind of the linkages between pesticide use in particular and human and ecosystem health. And also, I think there is maybe even in communities that historically, you know, may not have valued that as much, just the sense of wanting to support local producers, which, you know, aren't necessarily organic, but a lot of the smaller scale producers tend to be either certified organic or using organic methods because it's easier on that scale and when you're not kind of producing like commodity crops, essentially. That's where, you know, the farming is becoming more like a factory where you're just like filling inputs, outputs, you know, kind of more of a, it attempts to be more of a linear process. But as we know, there's a lot of things that aren't necessarily being factored into that balance sheet in the end, in terms of human health and biodiversity declines and things like that. So, yeah, I think that if people are wanting to support, you know, thriving local communities of all different types of small businesses and things like that. So hopefully that'll just continue to grow as, you know, potentially more far-flung agricultural systems, particularly here, like a lot of our organic produce does come from California that you find in stores. And with like the water situation in California this year, and it's just going to continue to increase, I would say, in terms of lack of water supply. I think we're going to be finding that those local producers are actually filling really important gaps as more and more crops potentially become unviable in California.
I'd like to move to your book for a minute and what it's about, and the title of it is Beyond the War on Invasive Species. Tell me about it.
My background is in organic agriculture, and so I've, you know, worked in that field for just about 20 years now. And several years ago, I got a job working in ecosystem restoration, and I had always known about, you know, people's concerns with invasive species and observed them myself in the landscape and hiking around and things like that. But when I started this job, it became clear to me pretty much on the first day when we were touring around that herbicide use, in this case Roundup, which is, you know, pretty ubiquitous in the restoration field, was kind of the primary tool that was being used in this site and kind of throughout the whole the whole world of ecosystem restoration was what I kind of came to find out. And I was really surprised as somebody that came from a background of organic farming, where, you know, if you're certified organic, you don't really, like, herbicide is just not in your tool belt. And so you think about other ways to address concerns that you're seeing pop up on the ground. And so my orientation has always been to think about things in a little bit of a deeper way. Because, you know, similar to conventional agriculture where, you know, pesticides, herbicides are just the go-to because the framework is everything is kind of in competition with the crop. And you want to just, you have to get it out of there. Everything's like an evil factor, right, when you're trying to make money off of this crop. And it's kind of similar in restoration. And I felt like there was a need to kind of address that just kind of conventional approach to invasive species and what we're really talking about when we're thinking about restoring an ecosystem by offering a more like holistic and permaculture-oriented approach to managing invasive species. So during the course of kind of working in this restoration job, I decided to start researching and ended up writing the book.
As you think for a minute about just kind of the overall picture of the work you do and what's going on, are there two or three things that you wish could be implemented right now to make a substantive change in awareness of relationships with the earth, regular living, etc.? Are there a couple of things that just come to mind that in your dream would happen?
Well, gosh, that's a big, big question. I would love to see, and this is kind of a tangent, but hopefully it makes sense. I would love to see schools, publicly funded schools, become spaces where kids and parents and other community members are engaged in agriculture, forestry, and restoration just as part of what they do. And I think that the way that we separate out, school and jobs and restoration and agriculture, it's all kind of siloed. But I think that if more people had the opportunity to meaningfully engage with land from the time that they're born or, at least go to school, and if public schools, these public spaces had spaces for parents to come and do remote work or volunteer once a week or teach their own skills, if we could kind of reimagine the whole way that we engage with young people and adults and people of all ages, using that as kind of a focal point, I think that could be really cool.
Awesome. Let's see what we can do. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's great to chat.
You've been listening to KLCC Media's The Oregon Grapevine, fresh pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live.